I'm Eric Michael Smith, and Formosa Files today is very honored to have an award-winning CNN reporter, also an author. Congratulations on the publication of your latest book, Assignment China, An Oral History of American Journalists in the People's Republic. I see that it's been translated into Mandarin, and it's also available as an ebook. I will put the links to all of your books in the show notes. Mike Chinoy, welcome to Formosa Files.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
The Taiwan History Podcast, Formosa Files, is made possible through the generous sponsorship of the Frank C. Chen Foundation. Formosa Files.
So, before we get going, am I insane or do you not have a Wikipedia page?
I don't have the slightest idea.
Because I searched all over and all I could find was these ones that sort of aped it. And one of them has your date of birth as June 38th, 2000.
Well, my birth date is kind of interesting because my birth date is the 4th of June, which is, of course, the date on which the crackdown in Tiananmen Square happened and on which the anniversary of the crackdown of Tiananmen Square gets marked every year. So I'm indelibly associated with it, not simply because it's my birthday, but because I was there and covered it for CNN, and the coverage of the Beijing Spring was a kind of moment that put CNN on the map in many ways before the first Gulf War of 1991, which really made CNN a household name. It was the Tiananmen crisis that first really brought the network to global attention. And I was in the middle of that, and it was my birthday.
Wow. You spoke to reporter David Frazier not long ago. He's also been on our program, and I don't want to give away too much of the article. People should read it. But you said that you were interested in Asia originally due to the Vietnam War.
I was a product of the Vietnam generation. I came of age in the late 60s and early 1970s when the Vietnam War was the sort of defining event for people of my generation, and we were told at the time that the war was being fought to stop the spread of communism, and the big bad communists who were behind the Vietnamese were, at least in the eyes of some of the defenders of the war in the American government, the communist Chinese. And since I was somebody who was potentially of draft age and had people that I knew who were going, and the whole issue of being for or against the war, it was convulsing American campuses and households, I got interested in trying to understand China. So I did a lot of reading and studying on my own. And then I had a chance to start studying Chinese. Actually, while still in high school, I was able to audit a course at a nearby college. And I kind of liked the language. And this was at a time when China was really very, very distant from the United States. It was essentially impossible to go. They were the big bad guys. But I had this interest. And then while I was in college, President Richard Nixon made his historic trip, and you had this unprecedented opening to China. And so suddenly it became a place which, while in many respects still seemed like going to the moon, was not wholly inaccessible to Americans. And in the summer of 1973, after I graduated from college, I managed to get myself onto a trip to China of American students organized by a left-wing New York-based magazine called The Guardian, no relationship to the UK Guardian that we know today. But I had a friend who had connections with the people at this magazine, and he knew I was interested in China. And most of the people were people like myself who'd been involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement and so on, had a sort of political interest in China, as well as I had a kind of cultural and linguistic interest. And so I was able to go to China for a month in the summer of 73. And this was really one of the very, very early trips by any Americans. And it was a fascinating experience. It was a sort of classic political trip in which everywhere you went, you were taken to people's communes and factories and got brief introductions from members of the Revolutionary Committee who told you how great everything was now because of the Cultural Revolution and how terrible it had been before the Cultural Revolution. And the Cultural Revolution was still going on. Mao was still alive. People were still wearing Mao buttons. Everybody dressed in shades of gray and blue and And foreigners were, people reacted to foreigners like you dropped from another planet. So it was a fascinating experience. And I got hooked and decided that one way to follow China and maybe get there was to be a journalist. So I decided to become a journalist. And here we are decades later, still sort of doing a similar thing.
When you were there at that age in 73, how much of the Mao communist happy, you know, how much of that did you buy?
Well, I think a lot of people at that time of my generation, don't forget that China had been the enemy and suddenly Nixon went and suddenly they were sort of friendly and kind of simpatico. And we were discovering that they weren't all just the, you know, the blue ants, the red hordes, and so on. And those of us who had been in the anti-war movement in the States or had been sympathetic to the civil rights movement in the States and looking at all the social problems that existed in the States, I think we're open to see whether or not this was a viable alternative as the Chinese claimed it to be. Of course, we know now that it was catastrophic in a great many ways. And, you know, even at the time, the limitations on being able to talk to people, the propaganda and so on, struck me as a bit silly. But I think we were, I suspect most of the people in my group had an element of, wow, this is something different and new and unusual. And is there something here for us to learn from? But for me, the longer I studied it, the faster I was disabused of the notion. That was just a fanciful notion. And when I moved to Hong Kong in late 1975 after going to graduate school and to make my way as a journalist, and I was a radio stringer for CBS News, was my first real job. And it turned out that 1976 was the first full year I was working as a journalist, and American journalists basically couldn't go to China. So you had to sit in Hong Kong. And 1976 was this cataclysmic year in China. It started with the death of Zhou Enlai. There was then the first Tiananmen Square riot in which Deng Xiaoping was purged for the second time. Then there was the Tangshan earthquake, which killed 250,000 people. Then Mao died. Then Mao's widow, Zhang Qing, and her followers, the so-called Gang of Four, were purged. So it was a huge news year in China, and you couldn't go to China as an American journalist. So it became essentially a radio story. So for me, it fell in my lap. And throwing myself into that, it was very clear what few illusions I had left about China were stripped away as you watch the incredibly nasty political infighting and purging and counter-purging and 250,000 people dying in an earthquake and China refusing to accept international aid and so on. So my illusions disappeared pretty quickly.
You mentioned the trip of President Nixon and Kissinger, of course, and then later it would be President Carter that enacted the actual switchover. So obviously, for those on the Taiwan side of the strait, that trip to China was not something very welcome. Neither was the 79 switch. How did you experience that?
Well, I was in Hong Kong, and my immediate reaction was, to be honest, well, if there's normalization of relations, then that might mean American news organizations would be allowed to open news bureaus in Beijing, which would give me a chance to go and live in China, which is what I wanted to do. I mean, obviously, there was a major geopolitical earthquake that came with the end of the formal diplomatic relations between Taiwan and the United States and the establishment of relations with China. Although I have to say, you know, there certainly were people who were very angry about it and understandably so, but it was, the benefit of hindsight, a pretty deft maneuver that has kept the peace for more than half a century and given Taiwan space to grow into this extraordinarily successful democratic society, unquestionably in many ways the freest in Asia, economic powerhouse. It has all of these weird games that frustrate people, like having to be Chinese Taipei when you participate in the Olympic Games and all of the other baggage that comes with an unresolved conflict. But when you consider the circumstances, it was a pretty clever diplomatic move that allowed the United States and China to have a diplomatic relationship, which two countries of that importance needed to have. And don't forget that while tensions are very high now, and you can revisit all of the moments in the Sino-American relationship where perhaps the Americans might have behaved differently, I think there's no question that the opening up of that relationship and China's embracing of economic reforms and becoming a less horrible society than it was under Mao, and all the many good things that happened to China, some of which are now being turned around, but over that 40-year period, were in part possible because of this diplomatic device that allowed the U.S. to maintain a relationship that was official in everything but name with Taiwan and still develop quite a deep relationship with China.
So you spent roughly two decades covering China, and there's just no way that you could have escaped the so-called quote-unquote Taiwan question. What was that like in the early days of being in China and having the Taiwan question come up?
Well, I was based in Hong Kong from 1975 to 1983, and then I was based in for CBS and then NBC News, and then I was joined CNN in early 83, and I was in London as a kind of roving international correspondent. And I spent most of those 5 years in war zones in Lebanon and in Africa and Northern Ireland and places like that, so I didn't pay a lot of attention to it. But then I moved to China in 1987 to open the CNN Beijing Bureau as the first CNN correspondent. And it was, again, it was an interesting period because that period when I was in China was the period when things began to change in Taiwan. And part of that change involved allowing a degree of contact back and forth, which led to travel and to trade and to investment and to the thaw and to the beginning of the web of quite deep interlocking relationships that exist today between Taiwan and China. So trying to chart that as a journalist was a fascinating phenomenon, especially since my first visit to Taiwan was in 1974. I'd been in the mainland in 73 and basically was not comfortable telling anybody that I'd been there because people would have been so suspicious of me. Don't forget, those were the days of martial law when the latest issue of Time magazine came in. The censors would take a pen and put the quotation marks around the word premier when there was a reference to Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai because they didn't recognize Zhou's legitimacy. So to go from that to watching Taiwan evolve, I was lucky enough to be here for the 96 election, the missile crisis in the 96 election, and then the 2000 election, the 2004 election, and made, you know, a half dozen or more trips a year. So I feel very lucky to have kind of followed it and to have witnessed the extraordinary transformation that we've seen.
So you're in China in 73, and then you're in Taiwan for the first time in 74. China obviously would have been much more locked in poverty. But other than that, like the political situations, how similar were they?
Well, the Kuomintang ran a very tight ship. But that being said, and politically, it was very locked down. And in fact, I remember there was a big controversy during that visit because some missionaries were trying to develop a Taiwanese English dictionary. And they got into political trouble because Taiwanese was not allowed to be spoken. So it was very tight politically, but in personal terms, the control over people's personal interactions was nowhere near as tight as in China. So in China, you really, you know, you could have a casual conversation on the street with somebody and immediately somebody else would come up and listen. And if more than a few people gathered, the police would come and shoo everybody away. That was my experience in 1973. In Taiwan, in 1974, you could chat with people, you could have meals with people, you could go to people's homes, you could have kind of normal personal interactions. But the moment you strayed into politics, you ran into this very tight political control. So that was, I think, quite a big difference.
If my memory is correct, I watched you cover the handover, or you were one of the journalists covering the handover of Hong Kong in 97. Is that correct? Is my memory correct?
That's right. I was the CNN correspondent in Hong Kong, and so I did the Hong Kong handover in 97 and the Macau handover from Portuguese to Chinese sovereignty in 99 as well. So I was sort of in the room watching both of those, which was quite interesting.
So I remember in 97 being 20 years old and having lived in China for a short time, Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan, And I remember thinking two things, feeling two opposing possibilities. And the first was like, oh, within a few months, they're going to just dump everything and say, this is what unequal treaties feel like. And then the other feeling was that maybe they'd pull it off, this one country, two systems thing. And then Taiwan would have to seriously talk about it being an option. I'm wondering what you felt during that.
Well, there was a great deal of uncertainty. It was a huge experiment, and nobody knew what was going to happen. And there were all of these sort of alarmist headlines, you know, the People's Liberation Army is going to march in and they're going to lock everybody up and so on. And, you know, it didn't happen. The day after the handover, Martin Lee, the pro-democracy leader, was in our CNN bureau giving an interview, and life went on. And there was certainly at one level watching the British leave. There was a corner of me that felt how utterly ridiculous that the British, 10,000 miles away, what in the world were they doing here? So you could sort of sense the kind of the rectification of a historical injustice on one level. On the other level, Tiananmen had only been not even a decade earlier, and people in Hong Kong had been profoundly scarred by that and were frightened of it. And nobody knew what was going to happen. But in point of fact, the first several years, for a variety of reasons, the Chinese authorities really kind of left it alone, left Hong Kong to its own devices. And I think, you know, what's happened in Hong Kong in recent years is tragic, and is there's lots of responsibility that goes around for it. I blame personally a lot on Hong Kong's own homegrown elite, who did a terribly bad job of managing Hong Kong after the handover, especially during and after the Asian financial crisis, and, you know, didn't address any of the kind of major social issues, housing, all of these kinds of questions. And then you had a political system which was structured in such a way to be unrepresentative because the Chinese were afraid of representative government. So you had people who were upset about a lot of issues that were not necessarily directly related to should Hong Kong be a part of a special administrative region of China, but just daily life, you know, practical concerns, where the tycoons who ran Hong Kong and the civil servants who were largely in their pockets just did a terrible job. And that alienated people, who then discovered they didn't have a mechanism to make any change. And I think to some degree, the democratic forces in Hong Kong, at least some of them, were kind of naive in not realizing that they were not dealing with the genial British at their parliamentary system anymore. They were ultimately dealing with the Chinese Communist Party, who play by different rules. And so decisions that might have been made that would have gotten them a quarter of a loaf or a half a loaf were rejected. And as a result, they not only lost the loaf, they lost everything, which is what we've seen now. But certainly the first decade after the handover, you had every year these annual commemorations of the Tiananmen Square crackdown in Victoria Park. You had very active opposition parties. You had 500,000 people march peacefully against the introduction of a national security law in 2003. So there was some sense that maybe this would work out. But as I say, between Hong Kong mishandling its own affairs and then political changes in China, which led to the emergence of Xi Jinping and a much harsher view about how China wanted to manage Hong Kong, and much more muscular approach to external affairs more generally, created this very toxic combination, which led to the 2019 disorders and the national security law, which has put an end to Hong Kong as we know it.
So 2020, of course, we had an election in Taiwan, and the Hong Kong situation was very much a factor in it. And it also definitely closed the doors, I believe, for anybody who thought that there could be some possibility of working with the Chinese Communist Party. You know, no way.
Well, one of the interesting questions here is, if China wants to win Taiwan back and not have a war to get it back, why did China adopt measures in Hong Kong that were so clearly going to send a signal to Taiwan of how unpleasant it might be? And I would say there are a couple of reasons for that, and they're related. I think one is, you can't exaggerate how much suspicion there was and remains in Beijing towards Hong Kong. Hong Kong was a kind of rebellious peripheral area permeated by foreigners and foreign values in a way that no other piece of China is. And then in 2019, it erupted into what had to appear to Xi Jinping and the people around him in Beijing as a violent uprising. I mean, the violence was ritualized compared to violence in many other places that I've covered, domestic turmoil, relatively almost, you know, sort of kabuki-like, a lot of smoke and mirrors and not that much actual people getting hurt. You know, a lot of running back and forth and tear gas, but very few dead bodies. But it looked like a violent uprising against the state. And I think that is something that spooks the Chinese Communist Party more than almost anything. And they are the Chinese Communist Party, the folks who did not mind that 40 million people starved to death during the Great Leap Forward, who did not mind all the turmoil and devastation caused by Mao's Cultural Revolution, who were perfectly willing to use tanks on their own best and brightest students in Beijing in 1989. So these are folks who don't mess around, and the consequences be damned. And so I think that overrode whatever counsel may or may not have been put forward in the corridors of power in Beijing that said, you know, we're not going to win a lot of friends in Taiwan if we go ahead and lock up every outspoken, critical, intellectual, journalistic, political voice in Hong Kong. When it comes to power, this other stuff falls by the wayside. And there's a lesson there for people in Taiwan, obviously.
And even earlier, when President Ma was in charge, and he actually met with Xi at one point, I think a lot of people here felt that we didn't get much from this thawing of relations. Some farmers got to sell some more guavas, or, you know, some more milkfish got sent over to China. But the tourists and all, in general, it didn't raise that much for the economy.
No, it largely didn't. And then, of course, there was a lot of popular unease at even being sort of sucked further into the Chinese economic orbit than was already happening. And so, of course, one of the big questions that I think, you know, is on the agenda today is, if that strategy by China has not worked, what are the other options that are left? Again, that's the subject for a whole other discussion. But I think, you know, under Xi Jinping, you've had a dramatic change, and the period of the sort of late 70s to the early mid 2000s. Really, you have to look now, you know, in the rearview mirror, in a sense, because that period is gone, and Xi Jinping has put political control, ideological conformity above everything else. You know, it's interesting. I wrote this book, Assignment China, which is an account by over 100. It's a sort of a self-portrait by over 100 journalists who covered China for the American media from the late 1940s to the present day. And the shift in the last sort of half dozen or 10 years away from the openness, the economic reforms, the relatively easy engagement with the outside world, the curiosity, the receptivity with foreigners, that really, in fits and starts, but that really characterized the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, and was a central feature in making China's economic boom so successful. And we've seen it, and all the journalists that I talked to who either are there or were there and had to leave were almost unanimous in talking about how one of the central features of the Xi Jinping period is the way in which that's really been almost reversed. And you're getting emergence of a kind of new model in which the period of reform and open door and so on, as people look back with kind of rose-tinted glasses, it wasn't it a great period? And in retrospect, compared to where China is now, it was.
Your latest book, Assignment China, An Oral History of American Journalists in the People's Republic.
The book is based on interviews with well over 100 people who give a behind-the-scenes look as to what it was like to cover China, you know, what it was like to be the Life magazine correspondent in Shanghai when the Red Army rolled in, or to be a China watcher in Hong Kong during the Cultural Revolution, or to fly on Nixon's press plane in 1972, or to be the photographer who took the famous photo of the man in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square. But I made a conscious decision not to have anything specifically on Taiwan, other than as a kind of part of the broader China story. And the reason is that the coverage of Taiwan is in and of itself so rich and so interesting and so important. And my book is already almost 500 pages long.
Gotcha.
I think nobody's going to read a 1,000-page book about journalists in China. There is a book waiting to be done, I think, about the history of journalists who've covered Taiwan. I will say one thing, though, that is addressed in Assignment China towards the end, which is that in 2020, the Chinese government expelled nearly 24 journalists from major American media like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post. And one of the and this is part of a general kind of closing off of China, and the overall number of foreign journalists based in the People's Republic is dramatically down from what it used to be. And the people who are there face great difficulties in terms of access and travel and being able to talk to people. And one of the consequences has been a significant increase in the number of foreign journalists who are based here in Taiwan. There are quite a lot of people who were kicked out of China who are here now. There are people who have applied for visas to go to the mainland and can't get them and are here now. And I think that has been, on balance, a very good thing, because it's allowed Taiwan to have more press coverage, not only of, you know, sort of the Taiwanese perspective on China and on the cross-strait issue, but Taiwan is an important place. It's one of the world's biggest economies. It's the semiconductor capital of the world. It's an extremely interesting society that has gone from being a dictatorship to Asia's most vibrant democracy. And of course, it is the quote unquote flashpoint that could set off a conflict between China and the US with God knows what kinds of horrible consequences. So it's important in its own right. And it used to be, and in my day as a journalist, when you would go to China, you would have to pitch your editors on what stories are you going to do. And they were always, you know, Taiwan-China tensions.
Yes.
That's still, you know, central to the coverage because the tensions are there. It's real. But I think having all these people who were in China and were kicked out, or who are here because they can't go to China, is kind of revising the balance a little bit in ways that allow a little bit more of Taiwan as a kind of living, breathing society in its own right, and not just as a pawn in the giant China-US-Taiwan triangular game, to be conveyed to people around the world. And so I think one of the consequences of China trying to shut down coverage within mainland China has been to boost coverage in Taiwan, which I'm sure is not what Beijing wants, but it's another own goal of the many that they have scored in recent years in their international behavior. And the result is that I think people around the world are getting a little bit better sense of Taiwan.
Awesome. So speaking of books, my co-host, John Ross, was asking before we close out here, if you had, other than, of course, your own book, Assignment China, if you had any other recommendations for East Asia books that, you know, you just have to read, must reads.
Well, I think Ian Johnson has this new book called Sparks, which is quite a remarkable book, which I would recommend very highly, which is an account of people in China who are sort of struggling to kind of keep an alternative version of modern Chinese history alive. And that, I think, is a book that I would very, very, very highly recommend.
Mike Chinoy, thank you for being on Formosa Files.
Thanks for having me.